Jim Van Wegenen, one of the senior defense staffers who handled the black accounts, recalled being in Wilson's office one day when a Pentagon official said, "We can't do that." Wilson responded, "Let me have the staff tell you how you can do it." He didn't give a tinker's damn how he was going to get what he wanted, remembers the staffer. He'd say, "It will hurt you, or you can make it easy on yourself." On day 5 of this 11th-hour campaign, Gust and Charlie thought they were on the verge of pulling off the $300 million reprogramming when one of Charlie's friends on the House Intelligence Committee told him there was a 7-7 deadlock vote and that the chairman, Lee Hamilton, intended to let the program die. Ordinarily, Charlie moved the House through humor, charm, and by doing things for his fellow representatives. But in this case, there was no time, so he sought out his secret benefactor, Tip O'Neill, and told the Speaker that the Democrats would be embarrassed if Hamilton didn't back down. He didn't need to say anything more. He knew that O'Neill, in spite of his leadership of the opposition to Reagan's Contra War, hated to have the party accused of being unpatriotic. "Tip, do you want to have the Democrats be responsible for pulling the rug out on the Mujahideen? There ain't no nuns over there, Tip, so you don't have to worry about that," Wilson added, referring to O'Neill's passionately anti-war sister, who was a Mary Knoll nun. When asked about Charlie's maneuvers to outflank Hamilton, the former speaker acknowledged that he had intervened to get the committee's approval. "We ironed things out behind the scenes, which was customary in those days," the speaker explained. It also helped that Charlie had delivered for Tip in the past. The battle now shifted to the task force, which had only a couple of days before the fiscal year ended, at midnight on September 30th. It was again a matter of use it or lose it, but by now Gust had become a master at playing this game. Hilly Billy, his finance guru, had taught him that the money does not actually have to be spent in a given year so long as it has been obligated to be spent. But that still meant that the task force only had a few days to get $300 million worth of contracts signed. It was almost comical, this mad dash to spend the money. Gust, Vickers, and the logistics chief, Tim Burton, had pre-positioned agents all over the world, Egypt, Switzerland, Pakistan, Singapore, and China, just waiting for an okay to commit the funds. Right up until midnight on the 30th, the wires were burning up as the cables confirming the contracts rolled in on deadline. In the end, Gust not only committed the $300 million, but a bit more just to be safe. Soon after, he and Casey flew off to Saudi Arabia to hit the Saudis up for their matching share. Now, Vickers had $600 million to add to the already immense budget. It had all taken place without a vote on the floor of Congress and without any public acknowledgement, but it was another turning point in the war, and the Kremlin had no idea that yet another enormous escalation was in the works. Because of the way the $300 million had to be committed ahead of time but not actually spent, Vickers realized that the CIA wouldn't have to spend it all by the next fiscal year as it normally would, with the rest of its congressionally appropriated budget. He convinced Gust that they could ration this money so that their budget could be maintained at about $750 million for the next 2 years. The Saudi matching funds, however, were not subject to the same congressional regulations. The Wilson of Rakatos partnership had now managed to elevate the agency's Afghan program beyond the normal budgetary control of Congress. Inexplicably, no one on the Hill, much less in the press, seemed to know about or pay any attention to this dubious achievement, in spite of the hyperactive scrutiny that Wilson's liberal colleagues were subjecting the agency to, with questions and accusations about every possible detail of the flagging Contra operation. It was another first, and Gust decided it was time to make some meaningful gesture to the man who had made all of this possible. Almost as a reward, or perhaps as an acknowledgement of the dominant role Wilson had come to play in this unprecedented CIA operation, Gust invited Wilson to come out to headquarters to visit his dirty dozen in the war room. It was all a thrill for Charlie, and to Avrakatos's surprise, when Charlie walked through the door, the task force members spontaneously stood and broke into applause. "I don't know what it did for his health, but you could see the rays of sunshine and pleasure emanate from him," remembers of Rakatos. "And you know what? It was sincere. No matter what each individual might once have thought of him, you could tell they were genuinely honored that Charlie, the great benefactor who was giving them the wherewithal to beat the shit out of the Russians, was visiting them." The additional $600 million on top of the already huge budget for 1986 represented such a radical increase that Avrakatos and Vickers had no choice but to prepare a detailed report, known as a Memorandum of Notification, MON, to alert the President to the fundamental change in the nature of the Afghan operation. It's a requirement that any time a CIA operation leaps out of the boundaries authorized by a finding, an MON must be submitted to the White House to make sure the President is still prepared to go along with it. Once again, Vickers was tasked with drafting the report, which had to begin by addressing the concern that the agency's escalation might be on the verge of provoking a Soviet invasion of Pakistan. For months now, Avrakatos had figured that if he were in command in Kabul, he would never have allowed a CIA escalation without responding in kind deep inside Pakistan. By now, he would already have burned down the port of Karachi, where the CIA weapons and ordnance ships were unloading tons of explosives each week. He would have sent saboteurs to seek out and bomb the munitions dumps spread out all around Peshawar. A hillside in Islamabad next to a mosque contained enough hidden explosives to blow up the capital. These were the obvious targets. There had been terrorist bombings and assassinations, but mostly in the border areas and not on a scale large enough to shake Zia's resolve. And so when this didn't happen, Gust argued that the Kremlin had already blinked and the agency was, in effect, free to escalate at will. That was the line of reasoning that Vickers set forth in the draft of the MON that Gust sent on to the seventh floor for review. Bill Casey, Claire George, Bob Gates, later to become DCI, and even the cautious John McMahon endorsed this call for all-out secret war. The CIA was going for broke. The fall of 1985 witnessed something new in the CIA's six-year-old Afghan war. The National Security bureaucracy suddenly discovered its significance. Charlie Wilson had started the bandwagon moving, but as in all great endeavors, others were now sensing opportunities and scrambling to jump on. It was impossible not to recognize that the Contra War was all but dead, but the President was now personally committed to the Afghan freedom fighters, and Congress was pouring unprecedented amounts into the agency's war chest. Afghanistan no longer looked like a sideshow. In the fall of 1985, the bureaucrats from State, the Pentagon, and the NSC who gathered in Room 208 of the old Executive Office Building were demanding the right to get in on the action. The CIA was simply not prepared for this new crowd of enthusiasts, who arrived on the scene armed with the deepest suspicions about the agency itself. Included in the entourage were some of the Vlasov's army advocates, as well as others who were beginning to argue that the Pentagon might be better suited to run this war. It was hard for any of the participants to appreciate how large and bold and radical the CIA's weapons and training program had already become. On one key point, however, they shared a common concern with Wilson, finding a silver bullet to shoot down the invincible helicopter gunships. The moving force in this group was an engaging, well-born conservative intellectual named Mike Pillsbury, then serving as the Pentagon's deputy undersecretary in charge of overseeing covert programs. Pillsbury, a former Senate staffer and China expert, had been an early believer in the Afghan campaign. He'd worked for Senator Gordon Humphrey at one point, but had also served as a kind of foreign policy Machiavelli for a string of other conservative senators, including Jesse Helms, Orrin Hatch, Chip Hecht, and, to a certain extent, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Malcolm Wallop. Repeatedly during 1985, he had tried to persuade the National Security Council to authorize the introduction of the American-made Stinger surface-to-air missile, widely acknowledged as the most effective mobile anti-aircraft weapon available. But each time Pillsbury had attempted to win approval, he'd failed. According to Pillsbury, his boss, Assistant Undersecretary of Defense Fred Ickle, had told him to give up the fight, but, undaunted, he redoubled his efforts to forge a critical alliance with Ambassador Mort Abramowitz, Secretary of State George Shultz's intelligence chief, and had brought in his own collection of aggressive, conservative senators to support his effort. Pillsbury's conviction, and hence that of his Senate group, was that the Afghans were not being given meaningful support, such as Stingers, because overly cautious and cowardly CIA officials were blocking it. His main source of these views was Vince Canestraro, the veteran CIA officer whom the White House had put in charge of reviewing intelligence operations, despite a recent reprimand for his role in the infamous Contra assassination manual. But among conservative intellectuals in the Reagan administration, like Pillsbury, Canestraro was seen as a martyr to the cause of anti-communism. Pillsbury says that he and other members of the 208 committee were deeply swayed by Canestraro's description of a CIA that had lost its way. He told us that Clair George was the enemy and that George and McMahon were stopping the Stinger. He said the only way to turn Casey around to support the Stinger was to do in McMahon. Pillsbury now suspects that Canestraro was, in effect, running a black propaganda operation out of the White House to bury John McMahon, the official responsible for derailing his career. At a bare minimum, he managed to unleash an unprecedented public attack on McMahon. From the moment Canestraro took Andrew Aieva aside in the old executive office building and told him that McMahon was the enemy of the Mujahideen, as well as the one responsible for blocking the Stinger, the desperately earnest Aieva had known what he had to do. With the exception of Philip Agee, American critics of the CIA have generally observed certain rules of engagement. The idea of identifying an agency official by name, accusing him of treasonous practices that cannot be verified, and mounting a political campaign to get him fired was simply unthinkable. But with Canestraro's words ringing in Aieva's ears, that was the course of action that he and Free the Eagle adopted when they launched a massive direct mailing to get the traitor. 100,000 letters were sent out to Free the Eagle's arch-conservative supporters seeking money to mount the campaign. Why does the CIA persist in failing to supply effective weapons to the Afghan freedom fighters? The letters asked. Why does the CIA choose to send weapons that are old, defective, and in some cases useless? Who's behind this massive and deadly blunder? To be perfectly honest, my friend, it's because a certain public official, namely John McMahon, is failing to carry out American policy. That's why I am asking you to sign the enclosed letter addressed to White House Chief of Staff Donald Regan and then mail it to him at the White House. John McMahon must change his ways or he must go.